Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe.
There's a great deal of people, corporations, individuals in a range of countries, the US, the Middle East, every corner of the globe, who actually see a worsening climate and a worse situation for refugees and never-ending war as a wonderful business opportunity.
That's journalist Anthony Lowenstein. We spend the hour with him talking about his book and forthcoming movie, Disaster Capitalism. This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rihanna. The term was first coined by Naomi Klein in her book The Shock Doctrine, Disaster Capitalism. It's about profiting from catastrophe, leaving the victims even worse off than they were before disaster struck. My guest, Anthony Lowenstein, delves deep into this apotheosis of the predatory corporatocracy in his new book, Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. Is global warming threatening your water supply? Through drought or by melting the glaciers that provide it. Multinational corporations are happy to privatize your water and sell it to those who can afford it. Has your country been struck by a devastating earthquake? Well, let's, quote, build it back better by taking over your homegrown industries with global corporations paying a wage of $5 or less a day. Or maybe your communities are falling apart because of the war on drugs fast track to incarceration. There's a private prison cell you can go back to after working for free for major corporations like Microsoft in your prison factory. For his book, Disaster Capitalism, Anthony Lowenstein discusses these and the many other ways that corporations bleed whatever profits they can from economic crisis. He talked to immigrants stuck in limbo in Britain and visited immigration centers in America. He debated with Western contractors in Afghanistan, met the locals in post-earthquake Haiti, and in Greece found a country at the mercy of vulture profiteers. Anthony Lowenstein is a Middle East-based Australian freelance journalist, author, documentarian, and blogger. A columnist for The Guardian, he's written for The New York Times, Washington Post, Counterpunch, and many other publications. His best-selling book on the Israel-Palestine conflict was My Israel Question, and he's the author of another bestseller, Prophets of Doom. He's also a contributor to several books of essays. His new book, Disaster Capitalism, is being made into a documentary film. Well, Anthony Lowenstein, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
This book, Disaster Capitalism, you open the book with a reference to the 1972 book, The Limits to Growth. It was written by Jorgen Randers. The quote by him, that it's profitable to let the world go to hell. What did he mean by that remark?
I think what he meant is that you can make a lot of money. He was talking about the context of climate, but I want to open the book with that quote because I think it says a few things. One, I think many of us who are critical of how wars are funded and made and refugees are treated sort of say, oh, climate change, this is a disaster, human rights are being abused, we need to do something about it. And that's obviously what I think. However, there's a great deal of people, corporations, individuals in a range of countries, the US, the Middle East, every corner of the globe, who actually see a worsening climate and a worse situation for refugees and never-ending war as a wonderful business opportunity. And that could be from anything to do with running a detention center for refugees. That could be people who produce the weapons the US and other countries use in Iraq, Afghanistan, elsewhere. That could be people in relation to climate change who are trying to sell, for example, high-end insurance. You live near a shoreline, there's a major disaster, possibly the local authorities can't reach you, but a privatized ambulance service or privatized other services could reach you. This happened during Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. And that was obviously more than 10 years ago now. So I think what we're seeing almost is the commodification of the world, which is not new, but I think it's massively accelerated in the last 20 years. And that comment to me shows that many years ago, back in the 70s, he was very prescient, sadly.
You also say that this kind of commoditization of the world, you say that, you know, we're getting almost to the point where there's the actual privatization of the natural world. So say a little bit more about what you mean by that.
I guess what I mean by that is that what we're seeing in relation to climate change, and I should say, listeners, that my book is not focusing on that issue, although I touch on it here and there unavoidably, is that in many areas of our sphere, whether it's water or resources or any kind of essential things for life, if you put a price on it, if you say that we should be able to charge for water, we should be able to charge for every essential service, that by definition means that many people can't afford it. And you see in many places around the world in the last 20 years, including particularly in, say, South America, you see more recently in the US with Flint, Michigan, of a botched, if not criminal, attempt by conservative authorities to try to privatize the water system, and the effect, of course, has been devastating for communities locally. And I was just actually watching a few days ago Michael Moore, the US filmmaker, talking about that, and he's, of course, from that area, saying that having spent time in that area recently, locals are devastated by how utterly, not just ineffective, but negligent the US president has been, Obama. Now, it wasn't Obama's fault that this happened by any means, but now that he knows it's happening, there's been little or no action, from according to Mike Moore, to actually address that. So my point being that if all essential services in life, services covering everything from electricity to water, are privatized, outsourced, do we think and do we believe as a civilization that there should be a price on everything? This is really a theme that runs through the book and a film I'm working on at the moment, also called Disaster Capitalism, which is a work in progress. That do we think there should be a price on everything? Do we think that everything should have a cost? Everything should be run by a private corporation? No, I don't think that because, for example, refugees are managed by the state, such as in the US, things are utopian. Far from it. The system in the US, as one example, this is putting aside the privatized aspect of the immigration system, the public sector of it is a complete disaster. Unaccountable, full of abuses. So this is not me idealizing the public sector. It's simply saying that unless there is accountability across the board and the private sector is less accountability, we have a serious problem. And I think the pushback against privatizing services, as you've seen in parts of the US, but particularly Europe in the last years, where a number of European cities and towns privatized water, huge pushback against that, including in Germany. And the effect of that has been quite positive. The state now controls water again, and it's obviously A, far cheaper, and B, more reliable.
It's interesting that you mention Europe. We're going to talk about Greece in a moment, but even before that, I wonder if you could address the issue of the Brexit. You know, the other example, Greece, you know, that was a question that came up with it as well. I remember being in Europe in 2001 and 2002, when the euro came in. The euro came in, I believe, 2002. Went back a year later in 2003. Prices had doubled in places that I was in southern France. And there was a lot of grumbling. And I think a lot of people in the United States think, oh my goodness, it must be just right-wingers who are against the European Union. Talk a little bit about the European Union within this context of disaster capitalism.
I think it's interesting you say this, that I'm someone who for a long time, having spent a lot of time in Greece and parts of Europe, have seen the utter devastation the European Union had wrought on vast parts of Europe. I'm talking about two particular issues. One, the Greek financial crisis, which has made Greece essentially a pauper state. I mean, Greece should be a rich country in Europe. The reality has been, though, in the last particularly 7 or 8 years since the global financial crisis, Greece was horribly mismanaged, to be sure, for many years, mostly by right-wing governments. And the effect of the European Union and others imposing crazy, insane austerity on that country, unaccountable, I might add, and even worse by the fact that Syriza, the left-wing government, came into power in early 2015. I talk about them in the book. I have to say, if I had another edition of the book, which is coming out early in 2017, my view about Syriza would certainly change. Syriza, I think, has been the great capitulator. For those who don't know, Syriza was a left political party that came into power pledging to end austerity, or at least curtail it. The truth is, here we are in the middle of 2016, that Syriza has not just capitulated, but in fact been more enthusiastic with austerity than the right-wing predecessor, arguably. This is affecting, obviously, locals, pensioners, the unemployed, refugees, to be sure. So the argument of how the EU has dealt with Greece in a completely unaccountable way is one definite reason to leave the EU. The other issue, of course, is refugees. And it's a long, complicated question, of course, of refugees. But what you've seen in the last year and a half, particularly since there's been a huge surge of refugees coming from Africa and the Middle East, 2015 going into 2016, has been Europe utterly not just incapable but unwilling to actually address the reasons why people are fleeing in the first place. So the effect of that has been that too many European countries, led by Brussels, the EU, the solution, so to speak, is building walls, supporting fences, doing dodgy deals with Turkey, essentially bribing Turkey and bribing Greece, for that matter, to take the refugees back away from so-called civilized Western Europe and putting them in places where, again, so-called civilized Western European countries don't have to deal with it. Now, when I was in the UK in late 2015, when I was launching my book, this issue was really a live one on the left. I'm talking about the refugee issue and the Greek issue. And many people, colleagues, friends, were saying when there's a vote to leave the EU, we're going to vote to leave. What's happened in the last 6 months, and I'll finish with this, has been, possibly unsurprisingly, an incredibly nationalistic, xenophobic, far-right argument in Britain that has had a lot of traction. And a lot of people in the UK, not unreasonably, like I'd argue with some supporters of Trump in the US, different but related, feel left out. Putting aside the racist aspect of that, I'm not defending that for a second. I'm simply saying that a lot of people feel left out by globalisation. And in the UK, it's easy to blame refugees and Muslims, which is what Trump is doing in the US as well during the election campaign there in your country. The problem is that the likely outcome of the UK leaving the EU is a not just a more right-wing Britain and a no more accountable European Union, but a much more xenophobic anti-refugee sentiment across the UK, and the left view about what we should do towards the EU, although it exists in Britain, those voices haven't been particularly loud apart from some here and there. So I don't know. I think there's one side of me that may consider to vote to remain in the European Union, but it's done with a great deal of reluctance.
In fact, the British parliamentarian who was assassinated, she was a great champion of the refugees as well as a supporter of remaining in the EU. Perhaps that was the reason. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Anthony Lowenstein about his book, Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. So back to the EU, but now turning a little bit more to Greece and the roots of the austerity, the crisis in Greece, the pauperization of Greece. Talk about how this is an example, both in terms of the causes as well as now the response to it, of disaster capitalism.
So Greece was a dictatorship until the last 40 years or so, and a lot of people I spent time with in Greece, I was there a few years ago, said that Greece is now, to some extent, obviously far more democratic than a dictatorship, but the vestiges of that those regimes never ended. What that means is that the big media moguls and the big industrialists have far, far, far too much power in Greece. They don't pay much tax, if any tax. The effect of that is, of course, the country doesn't take in much tax, which therefore means that its budgets are regularly blown out, and therefore it was mismanaged for decades. The effect of also that was that privatization was seen as a solution, outsourcing your essential services, selling off everything you can get your hands on. The financial crisis hits in 2008-09. The country's unprepared, essentially, and the economy crashes, unemployment goes through the roof, and right-wing parties still claim to be able to save the country from oblivion, but the only way they can do that is if the European Union and other financial bodies globally put a gun to their head and they say, we'll bail you out if you accept unbelievably restrictive terms. In other words, you must sell off your public assets. You must slash pensions. You must slash the health service. You must privatise much of these services. And the effect of that has been, as I said, a pauperisation of the country where healthcare has gone appallingly badly. I spent a lot of time when I was there with just average people who were trying to get basic services. I'm not talking about people who are trying to get surgeries, which clearly is a whole different level, just basic medicines. If unemployment as it is very high, people can't afford that. So the state, in theory at least, should step in. I know that America has a different view about healthcare, but in many European countries and in my birthplace in Australia, there is a degree of a safety net. It's far from perfect and it's full of problems, but there's a belief that you can go to a doctor and hopefully get basic, decent care and get some medicine, which, and the state pays for that, essentially, without the need for private insurance. And in Greece, that system has collapsed, where you now have civilian health centres, civilian hospitals set up, often by doctors who refuse to play this game of not accepting patients unless they have insurance. I met doctors who said to me that we have colleagues of ours who will simply not see a patient at a hospital unless he or she shows them their insurance. Now, I know in the US that's quite common. I know that. But in Greece, it's not. And in much of Europe, it has not been. And Australia, it's not. And austerity in Greece was so harsh that the society in many ways not collapsed, but it deteriorated greatly. The effect of that has been two things, briefly. One, the rise of the far right. So I spent quite a lot of time there with a party called Golden Dawn. Golden Dawn came out of a fringe neo-Nazi movement 20 years ago. And most countries have a neo-Nazi party or at least a far-right party. Golden Dawn is now the third biggest party in the Greek parliament. And it gets anywhere in the last years between 6 to 15% of the vote, depending on the election. This is a proudly neo-Nazi party. It is anti-refugee, of course, anti-Islam. It doesn't believe Greece should be in the EU. Now, it's not the ruling party, but it has a lot of influence. And in some ways, the collusion between far-right Golden Dawn and right-wing parties in Greece has allowed Golden Dawn to become the success it is today. And the kind of beatings and bashings and murders of refugees and Muslims and immigrants in the last 5 years has a lot to do with Golden Dawn. So when I spent time there in Greece, I was trying to examine two things. One, the collapse of the society because of European Union imposed austerity and the fact that privatising services has made this problem worse, and how that ties into the belief and the growing lack of sympathy for refugees. There are, to be sure, a lot of Greek civilians who support refugees and give them a lot of backing. I'm not saying all of Greece hates refugees. I'm saying, though, that there is a great swathe of the Greek population who too easily blame refugees and Muslims particularly, for the ills of their country. It has nothing to do with refugees. I mean, the economic problems in Greece have a lot to do with former leaders who didn't know how to manage a budget and account for their debts. And Greece really is in a grim place. And to me, I think Greece was almost the best example, but also the worst example, to show what extreme disaster capitalism means. When a country is basically threatened at the threat of complete collapse, that unless they sell off all their services and privatise the lot, they'll be allowed to completely disappear.
One of the things you say in this book, Anthony Lowenstein, in Disaster Capitalism, is that it not only does disaster capitalism profit from disaster, but also maintains it and sustains it. And I think this sounds like a perfect example, because the so-called remedy is actually killing the patient.
Absolutely. The way I define disaster capitalism is really people or corporations making money from misery. That could be war or refugees or aid or whatever, just to give listeners just a sense in case they don't know what the term means. You're absolutely right that the problem exists in, say, Greece, And the so-called solution, which they're told they have to adopt, is more of the same thing. And this is what is so crazy, because when the Syriza government, which came into power in January 2015, and has been in power ever since, a lot of their ministers, especially Yanis Varoufakis, who was the former finance minister, he's now left the government last year, 2015, he said very openly that when he was going to have meetings with European Union officials, finance ministers from the European Union and others, he was essentially told, there was not a literal gun to his head, but a metaphorical gun to his head, saying, we don't care if there's any government in your country. We don't care if this is not working. We're not going to back down and lose faith, so therefore we're going to keep doing this, this being imposing harsher and harsher austerity. And your people in Greece need to be made to suffer, because if Greece doesn't learn its lesson, other countries may follow. In other words, when there's been economic problems in Ireland, in Portugal, in other places, the warning to them is, if you don't accept Greek-style austerity, we will crush you. And Greece, sadly and tragically for the people there, have accepted this medicine, which I would argue Syriza didn't have to as much as they have, and arguably could have left the EU. That's a historical question now, which they chose not to take. But the effect in the Greek population now is a society, as I said, which is breaking down. And I fear, as the refugee crisis worsens across Europe, that parties like Golden Dawn, which are unashamedly neo-Nazi, parties like that, in fact, are hugely growing in popularity in Hungary, in France, in Germany. They're not in government, but in the next 5 or 10 years, I'm doing some work on this issue at the moment, I do fear that Europe is going to enter a phase of, if not far-right governments, certainly far-right movements that have a lot of influence and power, and that should worry us all, if history is any guide.
So you say that, you know, the government held a metaphorical gun to the head of Greece, saying, we're not going to lose face. But it's not just all about face, is it? I mean, aren't these Greek assets being snapped up for a song by German corporations? And aren't the German banks, you know, basically, you know, they made out like bandits from the Greek debt crisis?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. That one of the conditions, in fact, that Syriza signed in 2015 was a huge, huge gold rush of selling off public assets. German companies, German banks, amongst others, are the recipients of that. And it seems tragic to me that Greece accepted that. And, of course, the obvious question is, why did they do it? I understand why the German banks wanted to do it from their self-interest, but why did the Syriza government accept this? Why did they go along with this? And on one hand, it's actually impossible to know exactly why, because they're still in government and they're not going to reveal all their secrets. They may reveal it when they lose government at one point in the near future. But Yanis Varoufakis, as I said, the former finance minister, is out of government and has spoken about this quite honestly and says that he argues that people around him, Alexis Tsipras, who is the prime minister, and others, felt they had no choice. They feared a complete Greek economic collapse if they did not accept austerity. They tried to fight it. They tried to get a better deal. They failed. So this is what Varoufakis argues, and he argues that they should have fought harder. His colleagues disagreed. He was in the minority position. Although I should say the Syriza government today is divided in the extreme. I mean, a lot of people in the party are deeply ashamed of what their leadership is now doing. They did win another election earlier on this year, so they are seen as maybe the least bad option in the Greek political environment at the moment. But I think there are real questions about who is really benefiting financially from this. And as you rightly say, it's predominantly Greek industrialists and other big moguls in other parts of Europe and beyond. And the sad reality is that when those assets are sold, most of that money, A, does not go to Greece, and B, doesn't actually result in helping the Greek economy. In other words, the debt is so large, and Varoufakis again argues that it was on the table but rejected to get rid of this debt. In other words, there's actually no financial reason anymore for the EU to insist that this debt that Greece has should be honoured. In other words, this is again done that Greece is taught a lesson. We're going to make you suffer unless you pay off your debts, even though they know they're never going to be able to afford to pay off their debts. I mean, it's a crazy situation and a sad one, particularly for the Greek people, of course.
And now let's connect that up with how the Greek government has become, in effect, the jailer for Europe. You traveled with a blind Afghan refugee from Athens to Corinth. Tell us why you did that, why you went with him, and what you found when you got to Corinth.
So I was interested in the refugee issue before the huge refugee explosion in 2015. So of course, Greece was already dealing with refugees who had been coming, mostly from Africa and the Middle East, nothing like the numbers we've seen in the last year and a half or so. But I had read and knew that Greece was treating refugees terribly. They had locked people up often indefinitely. They were treating them and putting them in refugee camps, if you can call them that, people living in squalor. There was talk of privatising the refugee centres, obviously for profit. And this is a theme I've examined in other parts around the world, in Australia, in the US, that there is a growing tendency to try to make money from the refugee crisis, which of course has only expanded in the last year or so. So in Greece, I wanted to go to spend time with refugees. I wanted to understand their lives. I wanted to see where they were living. So I, through various contacts, found an Afghan refugee living in Greece. And I should say that the lives then, this is in 2014, the lives of refugees then in Greece was pretty bad. As I said, either in often interned indefinitely in a detention centre, living in squalor, or living in freedom, so to speak, with very, very few rights and not much access to services. And this man was blind, as I said. He was Afghan, living in Greece. And we went to Corinth, which is about an hour or so, hour and a half from Athens. It's a town nearby, quite poor. And there's a large detention centre there. And I wanted to speak to some refugees from, well, I figured they'd be from Afghanistan. There wasn't so many coming from Syria then. Of course, there are many coming from there now. And people were desperate. I couldn't literally get into the camp because it was locked up, but I was able to get access, which most people weren't able to get for different reasons. I guess through various contacts, I was able at least to speak to refugees for a short amount of time. People were complaining of guards mistreating them, of not being given enough food, of being not given enough medical care, of profound racism exhibited by prison guards. And I should say that in the last years, many of the police in Greece and detention centre guards, and there's been studies to prove this, often vote for Golden Dawn. I'm not saying every single prison guard is a neo-Nazi. I'm saying that there is disproportionate amounts of support for that group from these individuals, which is worrying because they're the ones who are supposed to be taking care of the most vulnerable. And I guess what that example showed me, and in other places around the world I cover for the book as well, is that the refugee crisis really is about not helping refugees. It's about trying to hide the problem, which is exactly what the European Union is trying to do now by, A, not providing enough boats and assistance to rescue people at sea, and two, trying to force successfully, sadly, Greece and others, as you say, to be the jailer. But of course now they're paying Greece to kick these refugees out and send them back to Turkey. Turkey, being a very undemocratic, increasingly authoritarian state, is, well, yes, looking after refugees to an extent. They've taken in millions of Syrian refugees in the last years, to be sure, but many human rights groups in the UN, no one accepts that Turkey lives up to its obligations to look after refugees in the optimum way. So Greece really is being given A, not enough money, B, not enough resources, and C, is being forced now to yet again be the bad guy of Europe by locking people up in appalling conditions. So what I saw and what I featured in the book, it's got 1,000 times worse in the last few years.
Well, that's just such a distressing story.
It's really disturbing. And I guess so, just one last thing on that that comes to mind is that I think when a lot of people think of the refugee crisis, and maybe not people listening to this show, but other people around the world, that they see a huge mass of people who are not productive and not contributing to society. Now, it's obvious maybe to say this, but let me say nonetheless that in Syria, for example, the education rate before the war was incredibly high. So a lot of refugees who are coming from Syria are educated people, men and women, and kids for that matter. That's changed, obviously, in the last years, tragically. But these are people who are going to contribute to society. But the rhetoric you increasingly hear in Europe, with exceptions, of course, is very much one of they're a threat, they're a threat, they're a threat. Mm-hmm. Either because they're all terrorists or because they're Muslims or whatever that may be the case. And I think the effect of that is not just profoundly racist and concerning for obvious reasons, but also it shows that Europe and other countries, Europe and other parts of the world see solutions in the so-called Israelification, I would argue, which is using Israel as a model in how you deal with people you don't want, namely building walls, building incredibly sophisticated surveillance, keeping people out, those people being Muslims, usually people of brown or black skin. I'm generalizing, of course, but that is increasingly, I think, how many European nations and the EU and the US and certainly Australia view refugees, which is very, very disturbing.
And we should tell our listeners that you, in fact, now live in Israel and Palestine.
I do. I am based in Jerusalem, yes, as a freelance journalist.
Anthony Lowenstein. Stay tuned for more of our conversation about his book, Disaster Capitalism, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour today with acclaimed Middle East-based journalist Anthony Lowenstein, talking about his book, Disaster Capitalism. It's a powerful indictment of the burgeoning global industry of profiting from misery through privatizing basic goods and services when disaster strikes. In the 21st century, the vulnerable have become the world's most valuable commodity. Before the break, we were talking about some of those most vulnerable, refugees coming from countries racked by conflict and war. We pick up the thread with a different kind of refugee, those whose communities have been destroyed by natural disaster. I'd like to move to Haiti because in some ways this is also a refugee crisis, an internal refugee crisis, the post-earthquake response, and very much another example of the corrupting and pernicious influence of disaster capitalism. I remember when Bill Clinton said, we're going to build Haiti back better after the earthquake. And the Clinton Foundation has been very involved in that process. So tell us what happened. How much has been built back, first of all?
Well, not much. I mean, we should say the earthquake happened in January 2010. I mean, the country was already on its knees before the earthquake. So that was already in desperate straits. Earthquake hits, absolutely disastrous, mostly around Port-au-Prince, which is the capital. No one knows the death toll. I mean, anywhere between 50,000 to 300,000 people, that death toll I know is massive, but no one really knows. There's a huge numbers of people. And the Clinton Foundation, Bill, Hillary, and increasingly now Chelsea, their daughter, have had a lot of involvement. People might not know this, but Hillary and Bill actually had their honeymoon in Haiti back in the day. And they've always expressed a deep love for Haiti, but I wish they would love Haiti a lot less because the effect of that so-called strangulation from them has been disastrous. The Clinton Foundation, and they're not the only bad guys here by any means, but you asked me about them. So there was great attempts after the earthquake by the Obama administration, by George W. Bush, who was put on a Haiti rescue mission, so to speak, with Bill Clinton to find a way, as you say, to rebuild Haiti with housing, with jobs, etc. Well, the effect now in 2016 is that Haiti remains not just the poorest country still in its hemisphere, but worse than that, actually, is that its political turmoil, the government that Obama administration under Hillary as Secretary of State put in place against the will of the people. The former leader, Michel Martelly, was profoundly corrupt, had not won the election fairly, but he was a favoured guy in Washington. And what you realize when you spend time there, and I've been there a number of times in the last years, is that Haiti is basically a US client state. And Haiti's role, from Washington's perspective, is to be a place to make clothing and goods for the US and foreign market. So what you've had in Haiti for the last decades, long before the earthquake and since the earthquake, is US corporations and others building these so-called industrial parks, which is basically another word for sweatshops, to make clothes for the Gap and Walmart and other US manufacturers. And the solution, so to speak, that the Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration put in place after the earthquake in 2010 was the same failed mission. They talk about putting something in place in northern Haiti. It's called Caracol. It's supposed to provide tens of thousands of jobs. There's maybe 5,000 jobs now tops. And I spent time there a few years ago. Locals are underpaid. Living conditions are terrible. Environmental concerns around the site were ignored. And also, I might add, this is nowhere near the earthquake zone anyway. I mean, the earthquake happens in Port-au-Prince and Caracol is in the north of the country, nowhere near the earthquake zone. And what's so tragic about this is that Hillary, now that she's a candidate for president and the likely president of the US, these are the kind of policies that she believes is a solution for places like Haiti and many other countries, which namely is a compliant dictator in a foreign country, convincing through arm-twisting corporations to invest in, say, Haiti. So in Haiti, it was a company called Saya, which is a South Korean company. They built this industrial park in the north of the country. But it's been a disaster. As I said, there's been very, very few jobs and opportunities have been poor. And there's been very few, if any, questions towards her or the Clinton Foundation of any serious note during this election campaign, which I think says a lot about the poor state of the American press. But Haiti itself is in a very, very bad state, and political unrest is growing, and violence, which has already happened, is likely to increase. It's an absolute perfect storm there. It's tragic.
In fact, you say that Haitian workers are earning less now than during the time of the baby doc dictatorship. And I have also heard that Hillary Clinton herself and the Clinton Foundation tried to get the minimum wage to be decreased from where it is currently. That's $5 a day. In fact, workers and these industrial parks are making less than the minimum wage. $5 a day, not an hour.
Okay. Absolutely. And that, of course, gives you a real insight into how not just crazy neoliberalism operates, but how disaster capitalism actually works, which is the argument that says we have to reduce wages to increase competition and increase the chances of business to operate simply does not work. I mean, in Haiti, it's a good example of that, where $5 a day, which is obviously $5 US a day, is barely enough people to survive. And people I was speaking to were getting that wage. They had two problems. One, they often have to pay for public transport to get from their home to the industrial park. That costs them $1. They have to pay for food at the site. That costs them $1. So that's $3 a day. So that's one issue, two issues. And the third issue is, and I met a number of people, and this people feature in my film that I'm working on now called The Same Thing, Disaster Capitalism, is that people often leave these industrial parks saying, I can earn more money, not much, but more, if I work for myself. So one woman I spent time with who's in our film is living now in a slum, but nonetheless she runs a little sewing business. Now, I don't know exactly how much money she's earning, but it's more than $5 a day. Maybe it's $6 or $7 or $8 a day, but this just shows you the actual economic vandalism that is imposed from Washington. It's made worse and even the more tragic when the countless Haitian politicians from the bad old dictator days, Baby Doc and others, to the modern times, are more than happy, through corruption, through bribery, through other means, to accept their marching orders, not from the Haitian people, but from Washington, D.C. And this is the case with Republicans or Democrats. Doesn't really make much of a difference.
And then the role of the NGOs. Now, of course, the Clinton Foundation is one of these NGOs, but by no means the only one. I can, in fact, remember a time, about 15 years ago, when I was speaking with someone who had was working for an NGO in Haiti. And she was telling me, much to my kind of, jaw-dropped surprise, just how high on the hog NGO workers were able to live in Haiti. Oh, you have your own home. It's, a magnificent home, and you've got your own servants. And I was thinking to myself, wow, I thought NGOs were supposed to be working for the people.
Yeah. Well, it's a complicated picture there, and one of the things that I think I should make clear is I'm not arguing, or my research has not shown, that every NGO worker in Haiti or anywhere else are living like kings. They're not. There are certainly some in management at the UN who do, which is a major, major problem. I was living in South Sudan last year, and it's a tough environment, and a lot of NGO workers and the UN are doing invaluable work in a country that's basically collapsed. Having said that, there are profound problems in a place like Haiti and South Sudan and elsewhere. I sort of call the NGOization of modern issues and modern conflict, namely that when the state itself can't provide for its own citizens, for whatever reason, corruption, incompetence, whatever, NGOs, the UN step in, might step in, and sometimes they're doing valuable work. After the earthquake, for example, in Haiti, NGOs provided some invaluable assistance, water, food, sanitation, hygiene, to be sure. The problem was, both then and now, is that too frequently NGOs weren't actually, their goal was not necessarily to help local people, it was to make profit. And what I mean by that is that a few short examples. So the earthquake happens, and through WikiLeaks documents, we know that the then US ambassador put out a cable designed for US businesses saying, his words, it's a gold rush. Now, what he meant by that wasn't just for US businesses to make money. He was also talking about NGOs. And one of the things that became very clear through my research was that the Obama administration pledged about $10 billion, which sounds fantastic, a lot of money. But the problem was, a lot of that money never arrived, issue number one. Issue number two was a lot of that money never left the US. What I mean by that is that it's basically going to US contractors who are paying themselves, US staff, not Haitian staff. So you go to Haiti, as I have, and Haitians will regularly say, where's the money? Where's this money gone? Where has this environment gone? Why have we not seen this money? Why are NGO workers and some UN people living very well? Why are they having an existence that we can't have? Why aren't we getting training? Why aren't we getting support? Why aren't we getting jobs? Now, Haiti has not collapsed because of the UN. Haiti has not collapsed simply because of a few NGOs, not at all. But what has happened in places like Haiti and elsewhere is that there is too often not been engagement with local people, and often NGOs, when you speak to them privately, not so much publicly, will acknowledge this, that unless you empower local people, locals will see NGOs coming in and going out. One example, finally. So the American Red Cross raised a lot of money after the earthquake for earthquake relief. And there's been a lot of investigations into this, particularly by ProPublica, the philanthropic great news organization based in the US and some in the US Congress, essentially finding that after all the money that the Red Cross said they'd invested, they had built 6 homes in Haiti. And much of that money had disappeared and had gone into Red Cross coffers. Now, they're not suggesting all of it's gone necessarily to, the corrupt back pockets of the American Red Cross. They're saying that administration costs was at least a quarter, which is kind of insane. I mean, this is the thing. What I try to argue in the book with Haiti and elsewhere is people should be a lot more considerate and thoughtful where they give their aid money. This is not an argument to say earthquake happens in Haiti, don't give money. Not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that it's not that difficult actually to find out in many ways where your money is going. Is the organization giving money to accountable? Does it actually work with local Haitians, for example? Does it actually empower them? Does it give them jobs? Does it give them training? Some will and some won't. And I like to think that the American Red Cross, which is the most popular American NGO when disaster strikes, both internationally and locally, will now be rightly tainted because their record, not just in Haiti, but also, for example, after Hurricane Sandy in New York as well, the delivery was terrible of essential services. So it's really just asking these key questions, which I think too few people are doing.
And finally, Anthony Lowenstein, in your book Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe, you moved to the U.S., I think in a very important place, and in the time that we have left, I'd like to ask you about the prison system. The whole privatization of the prison system with CCA, I remember, in fact, that, you know, the Clintons have not been untainted by their association with this as well, although, of course, they're not the only U.S. politicians to be so. Talk about the privatization of U.S. prisons and the impact that that has had.
So my focus in the book really is twofold here on the U.S. One, that both the immigration system and the private prison system have become metaphors in some ways for how the US views itself and exports that to the world. In other words, there is a belief, two things here. One, the US has a belief for a range of reasons. When I say the US, I'm talking about, I guess, the political elites in mass incarceration culture. I mean, that's not the first one to say that. A lot of people said it before me, they'll say it after me. But one angle which is less talked about with mass incarceration, this is I'm talking both here with prisoners, every night in the US now there's anywhere between 2.2 and 2.3 million Americans behind bars every night, disproportionately African Americans and Latinos, whites as well, of course, but minorities are disproportionately affected. There are less immigrants locked up every night, but many of them are locked up as well, mostly from South and Central America, often fleeing conflicts and regimes that the US has backed, which is not talked about so much. Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala, and others. One of the things I focused on in the book is the corporations who are making money from these crises. CCA and GEO Group are the biggest ones. And as you rightly say, Hillary Clinton as a candidate, both when she ran for the US Senate years ago and now when she's running for president, has accepted money from these corporations. She's not alone, as you say, many have. And you can't help but think that this profoundly corrupts the process, as it does, for that matter, with the NRA giving insane amounts of money to US politicians as well, as an aside. So one of the things I focus on in the book is spending time at a very depressing detention center in Georgia. It was, at the time, one of the biggest in the country. It's in a little town called Lumpkin. It's 3 hours from Atlanta. And this is where you have roughly 2,000 immigrants who are housed there, as I said, mostly from Latin and South America and mostly in that part of the world. And the conditions there are bad. Food is bad. Medical care is bad. Psychological care is poor. It makes sense from the corporation's perspective that they will pay as little as possible for services. One of the crazy aspects of this process is that many U.S. states signed deals with CCA and GEO and others. It's almost like a bad quota policy. In other words, the state agrees with the corporation's contract that says if we have less than 90% occupancy, 100% occupancy, whatever it may be, we will pay the corporation a fine because we're not abiding by the contract. And that happens more than you believe. The effect of that, which filters down everywhere from judges and sheriffs and others, is that we need to incarcerate people. Now, I'm not saying everyone's on the take or taking money, although there have been cases of judges who have been on the take of private prison corporations ensuring that people are put away to private facilities. But I'm saying that culturally it leaves a pretty ugly aftertaste because it shows that the US views these people both as expendable. B, it's very, very difficult to get access to these facilities. For me to get into some of these places took months and months of planning, very, very difficult to do. These people are mostly voiceless because the press, with exceptions, doesn't really interview them, speak to them, get access to them. And the reason I say I think this is a really disturbing metaphor of how the US both sees itself but also increasingly advertises itself to the world, perfectly, I suppose, by Donald Trump and people around him, is You build walls, you lock people up, and you send them away back to their country. And we shouldn't forget that President Obama, this supposed great liberal humanitarian, has deported more people in his time in office than the Bush administration. We shouldn't forget that. More people than
right,
the Bush administration.
The deporter-in-chief. Well, exactly. It also seems that when governments, because they've cut taxes or failed to raise them, governments are bankrupt themselves, when it's going to be more than just culture that's going to push them to, in fact, maintain these contracts if they have to pay a fine if they don't supply the prisoners.
It's a very good point. And one thing also, which the real challenge is going to be, I know there are a number of politicians now in the US, on both the Republican and Democrat side, that's true, who are at least talking about some kind of criminal justice reform, which is great. Whether it actually happens, let's wait and see in the next few years. The pushback is already happening, though. Private prison corporations are petrified of reform because reform means less beds being filled every night. That's for either immigrants or prisoners. So that is a real question moving forward, to the point where a lot of these private prison and immigration corporations' annual reports and in other places, they explicitly say, we're against reform. We're against Obama, for example, releasing certain drug offenders. We're against certain states legalizing marijuana, because, of course, less people will be put in jail for that. In other words, there is a not just an ideological but also a corporate battle going on, mostly behind the scenes, between at least some people who believe rightly that the U.S. mass incarceration culture is absolutely insane, has actually achieved nothing in terms of what it's aimed to do. I mean, it's been a war on minorities. Arguably, as Ta-Nehisi Coates has written in many places, for the African-American community, mass incarceration is a modern form of slavery, and I share his view on that absolutely completely. But what is equally important in that is there are people making a killing from that. Geo Group, CCA, and I might add a number of politicians who are on the take of those companies as well. And they, to me, should be not just named and shamed, and this is, I know campaign finance reform is almost a dead issue in the US, tragically, but to me, the fact that politicians in the election cycle can receive massive funding from these corporations and then unsurprisingly back the idea of mass incarceration, that to me should be illegal. That's coming from a, shall we say, more progressive point of view. And in Australia, where I come from originally, money has corrupted the system, but not to the extent we see in the US, thankfully, not yet anyway.
Right. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Anthony Lowenstein about his book, Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. There's another way that these corporations make money, and in the minute or two that we do have left, you mentioned slavery. Talk about the fact that these corporations are paying prisoners, 23 cents an hour or less or nothing, to churn out products for companies like Microsoft and, and others. I mean, tell us some of the corporations, major corporations.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, isn't it? I mean, I didn't know a lot about this until I was researching this book. I guess that's just my ignorance about this, but it's not something you read much about. In short, so I was in Georgia, for example, and the number plates that you see on cars are often made by prisoners. Now, you could argue, as some do, that it gives good experience to prisoners, and I can see the point that I think rehabilitation within the prison system is utterly vital. I've got no problem with rehabilitation, teaching people skills. I've got no problem with that whatsoever, because when they get released, then they can be productive members of society. Wonderful, great idea. However, in many of these cases, the corporations that are getting this labor are paying little or no money at all. So it's basically akin to slave labor. And that, to me, is utterly unacceptable, to the point where there's a growing movement across the US, both by prisoners and prisoner rights groups, to refuse to do the work, to sort of say, we may be in prison, but we have the right to earn a decent living, some living, more than a dollar a day, a dollar an hour. I mean, it's slave labor. And I think there needs to be a lot more exposure of which companies are making money from that.
Well, I mean, in fact, also it's competition. I mean, if you have mass incarceration and then the use of, where the prison companies are being paid to house prisoners, enforcing 100%, occupancy rate, and then using those prisoners to turn around and make even more money, isn't this kind of rigged against workers on the outside?
Of course. Well, I mean, it's exactly, it's rigged against everybody in a way. As I said, I mean, I think that there is definitely a way to have a reputable, honest rehabilitation program where outside companies provide support to prisoners in jail to get training and pay them a decent wage. As I said before, I think a lot of people would have no problem with that. In fact, I think the problem too often in the US prison system is there is no real rehabilitation at all. That's the key issue. Teaching people how to do skills, whether it's, auto engineering or, building furniture, totally fine. I mean, I encourage that. But the issue, I think, too often is that because of privatization and disaster capitalism mindset, people are seen simply as numbers and as cheap labor rather than as potential future workers in a productive society.
And your book is Disaster Capitalism, Making a Killing Out of Catastrophe. Anthony Lowenstein, we could be talking for many more hours. We've basically skimmed the surface here.
This has been great to speak to you. I really appreciate it. It's been interesting.
Yeah, and also we want to let our listeners know, as you've said, you are in the midst of producing a film about this. We really look forward to that. You had a GoFundMe page, is that right? Have you been able to raise the funds, and are you still looking for help from the general public?
I am. So briefly, I've been doing this film for 5 years, the same time as the book. The film features Afghanistan, Haiti, and Papua New Guinea, which also feature in the book, but it's separate to the book, but I guess you'd say inspired by the book. I'm working with a US filmmaker, and we're nearly finished. People can go to disastercapitalismfilm.com. All the information is there. We are still raising money. The film will be finished this year. We're raising money, though, for a rough cut. The rough cut's being done at the moment. It's going to be a feature film, but also the option of TV showing, which obviously means an hour or less. And it touches on the similar issues, of course, to the book, but more focuses on the question of aid and the corrupting influence of aid in those three countries. I'm in the film. Well, the focus of the film, I'm a journalist telling the story, and there's a trailer and clips on the website, so I ask people to check it out and hopefully give us some support. We'd appreciate that.
Well, that's great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Anthony Lowenstein. Go to writersvoice.net to see a trailer for his new film based on his book, Disaster Capitalism. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.